Accession number 18335, Reel 1.
Ken Lakeman, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Plympton, South Devon.
Which year was this?
1922.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Plympton?
For the first 8 years or so. Then we moved to Lera, which is about 4 or 5 miles from Plympton, towards Plymouth.
How old were you when you left school?
16.
In 1938?
That's right.
Did you get a job?
I did, yes.
Doing what?
I was on the old Great Western Railway, for which I was very proud to be a member of it, in a clerical capacity.
Is that the job you were doing when war was declared?
Yes.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
I did indeed, yes.
Under what circumstances?
I was at home with my mother and father, and I remember the broadcast vividly.
Did you have any reaction, any feelings about it?
Yes. Not exactly fear, but trepidation. I'd heard my parents and relatives, uncles and that, who'd served in the First World War, talk about it. And I think we all thought that there wouldn't be a Second World War. And when it did come, initially, I think it was, good Lord, what's going to be the future?
Were your parents very upset?
Yes. I suppose they had... They envisaged me being taken away at some time when I became of age to join up. And being an only son, I suppose, yes, particularly my mother, they were very upset, both of them.
What had your father done for a living?
He, too, was on the old Great Western Railway. He was the area representative for Cornwall.
Were you in any early bombing of Britain by the German Air Force?
Very minimal. We had one or two bombs in Penzance where we were living then. The bombers would come over the Atlantic, the English Channel, looking for naval vessels and convoys. And if perchance they couldn't find any or see any, they wouldn't take their loads back. So they would come inland and just drop them, hopefully. And we did have several bombs in and around the outskirts of Penzance and West Cornwall, which I think killed a few people and did a lot of damage, but not bombing as we know it, not like Plymouth.
Do you remember any specific streets or buildings that were hit in Penzance area?
Yes, just outside the railway station. And I was working then, and I went down early morning to open up the booking office. And when I put my key in the door just fell out and all the glass just collapsed. I hadn't realized that the station had been not hit exactly, but suffered structural damage. And as soon as I interfered with the door, the whole lot collapsed. Tickets all over the floor, soot down the chimney.
Did the building have to come down?
No, they jacked it up and they repaired it eventually. But it was out of action for a few days.
Were the trains disrupted?
No, well, they were running very late, very haphazardly. I mean, it was a termini, as you probably know. And they did try to start on time, but there was always problems with rolling stock coming in late because of air raids. And, of course, the bridge over the Tamar, they would... sometimes have to stop the trains there on a moonlit night, and if there's any bombing raids on in Plymouth or the area, Devonport. And the rolling stock didn't always come down in time to be turned around to go back again the following day.
Any other bombs that you remember that hit Penzance?
Yes, there was another one which landed about 300 yards or 400 yards from my parents' house, and I ran up to see if I could do anything or help. And one young girl was screaming hysterically. She'd be about 13 years old. And I managed to calm her down and ask her where she lived to take her back. And it transpired that her father had been a naval seaman and had gone down on the Thetis, the submarine. And, you know, it was rather ironic that I met somebody like that through bomb falling. And funnily enough, as she grew up into a young woman and had a family, we remained friendly. She said I managed to calm her and looked after her, and she was always grateful for that.
What was your address at that time?
1 Penulvern Drive, Penzance.
Did you know anybody who fell casualty to the bombing?
No. No, I can't say I did. There was a lot of bombs dropped on the outskirts of the town in farmland and horticultural land, which we were grateful for. We didn't want any damage in the town. And I do recall one Sunday morning walking along the Penzance Promenade with the lady who became my wife, and we suddenly saw this boat in Mounts Bay just disintegrate, and then we heard the explosion. And it was a minesweeper, or a boat acting as a minesweeper, and it hit a mine. And I believe there was casualties there, half a dozen or more killed.
Did native Cornish people consider it to be their war just as much as people in the rest of England?
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, they're very patriotic.
Did the war affect you in any other ways before you joined the services?
I don't think so. I couldn't wait for the day to join up and do my little bit, because some of my friends were a little older than me and they were volunteering. And I, having come from a naval-linked family, one of my uncles had served his lifetime in the Navy, and I'd always been going to Navy days as a boy in Plymouth, so I thought I'll join the Navy. And I volunteered, and I went up to Plymouth for an interview. This would be in 1940, 39 or 40, I wouldn't be sure. Passed the medical and the interviewer, but when they interviewed me, they said, "You're underage," so I couldn't be 18 then. "And also, you're in a reserved occupation, railways. But when you become of age, we will take you." So I came home rather disappointed. But having said that, when it was over, I went into North Road Station and had a cup of tea waiting for my train to come down from London to Penzance. And I met a soldier there and we started chatting. And he gave me his name and I've never forgotten it. He was called Stan Boundy. And he was a Plymouth lad. And he was a dispatch rider in the Royal Corps of Signals. And he painted a wonderful picture. I'd told him I'd been up for the Royal Navy, and I passed, and I hoped to get in. So I said I'd thought about the Navy in preference to the Army. "Oh," he said, "if you want a good life and adventures in one and see the world and a good crowd of fellows, Royal Signals," he said, "Royal Corps Signals." And he said, "there's line mechanics and wireless operators, dispatch riders," and he made it sound so interesting. And the fact that he impressed upon me was that you saw a lot of the world, and not like the Navy does, just going into one port and back again. When you went through a country, you went through a country. So I always bore that in the back of my mind. The Royal Corps of Signals seems a damn good outfit. So then one or two other of my friends were joining up in the army and the RAF and the Navy. So I volunteered again, this time for the Royal Corps of Signals. And within a few weeks, they asked me to go to Redruth, to the recruiting office for an interview and a medical, which I did. And again, I thought, this is being on the railway, although I was 18 then, waiting call-up. I thought, well, they'll probably keep me here for a few months anyway, because they were getting pretty desperate on the railways, because so much of the staff who were of military age were called up, you see. And within about 8 weeks, I'd been accepted and had joined the Royal Corps of Signals, which I was grateful.
When did you join? Join up?
I think it was June 1941. June, July 1941.
Where did you do your basic training?
My basic training, all the foot slogging and infantry stuff and everything, was a place called Ossett, near Wakefield in Yorkshire.
What was the basic training like for you?
I rather enjoyed it. I must confess, we had a squad of about 35 people, and I was very proud and pleased to receive the belt, as it were, of that squad and be promoted to acting unpaid lance corporal after 8 weeks or 10 weeks or so of training. So I must have impressed them.
How did you cope with army discipline?
I knuckled down. I enjoyed it. I think discipline is a very fine thing. Not, I didn't agree with everything, but basically I could see the rights of it.
How did the people in charge of the basic training treat the recruits?
Generally, very well indeed. There was the odd one or two that you wished far away and you queried their parentage, but generally speaking, I have no complaints at all. And one very interesting thing, on my way to join up, coming as I did from Penzance, I had several changes on the railway to get up there. And on Stalybridge Station, I saw another young fellow, and I heard him ask the railwayman there for the next train to Ossett. And I said to him, by any chance, would you be joining the army? He said, yes, I am. So we introduced ourselves, and he's been my friend right up to this day. We're still in touch. So that's 57 years ago. He stayed in the army as a brigadier, but we're very great friends.
So these odd one or two NCOs that you mentioned in the basic training, what specifically did they do that made you question their parentage?
Well, I mean, they had to enforce very strict discipline. And some of the language that they use I felt was unnecessary. And some of the things they did as punishment I thought was a little bit harsh. But the general idea was to get people to really toe the line and do as they think.
What did they do for punishment?
Lots of cookhouse duties, cleaning pots and pans and all sorts of unearthly errors. Lots of barrack room chores, you know, scrubbing the place clean. As soon as you finish scrubbing, I didn't have to do it, but as soon as people finished scrubbing it, they'd march in with their muddy boots and then have to scrub it all over again. Having said that, there was one or two very rebellious types that found their way in. And one or two are absolutely not cut out for the forces of any description.
In what sense?
Well, initially for the first week when we joined up, maybe longer, 8 or 9 days, there was a distinct shortage of uniforms and footwear. So we were allowed to wear the civilian clothes with which we'd gone to join up in. And whilst we had these clothes on, we were treated like civilians, very politely. Don't say we were called sir, anything like that, but it was, will you please, thank you very much. And then they said, your uniforms have arrived. So we go down to the quartermaster stores, and if you were 5'10", as I was, and very slightly built, and you found yourself with a uniform that would fit somebody 6'2", and a waist girdle of about 40, you know, and the big fella next to you had one that would have fitted a chap much smaller than you, we looked a really odd lot. But the fellow I was thinking about was, he was discharged eventually, and I think he was a bit of a pufta. Because he brought in, came with a silk dressing gown and silk pajamas, and of course you can just imagine the ribald leg pulling from a squad of some 30 odd boys.
Did he seem to be a homosexual?
I've no reason to say that. Possibly he could have been, but he certainly was effeminate. And I mean, everything was, oh dear, I can't do that. Oh my word. And, you know, twice round the barrack square, oh, my sergeant, my feet are killing me. Look, I've got a blister, you know. So it was always a bit of a leg pull. But I don't think he finished the training. If he did, it was about eight, after 7 or 8 weeks, and he disappeared. What happened to him, I have no idea at all.
But once you got the uniforms, did the attitude of the NCOs change?
Yes. We had a good laugh because the friend I told you about, David Danger, he and I went in the mess room with our mess tins, who were bright and shiny, you know. And it was a rather revolting looking stew that's being served up. And I remember David said, oh, Corporal, he said, have I got a choice? He said, yes, take it or bloody well leave it. Which was a little bit different from the previous few days, but it was, well, not really, you know, but you'll enjoy it if you try it. Yeah. It was a great leveller. And at 17, 18 as we were then, you know, it's a bit of a shake-up after being looked after by mother.
How did the different recruits get on with each other?
Very, very well indeed. Generally speaking, we were a mixed bunch. We found out what our previous occupations were and trades, and David himself was a bank clerk, I was a railway clerk, one of our friends was a schoolmaster, training to be a schoolmaster, and another one had been a lorry a bus driver, but we all mixed in and got on famously.
Do you think the basic training did you much good?
Yes, on reflection, I'm sure it did. And I hadn't really considered it before, but I think that these public schools and that these OCTUs and things like that, and the people joining the Territorial Army, I think the discipline and the comradeship is good for people generally.
What was the next step after Ossett?
I was sent to a holding battalion at Kirkburton in near Huddersfield. And from there, they pick out the trade you're going to be, and I was assigned to be a wireless operator, line and wireless operator. And there were all signals trades there. And they would come around the camp and they were finding replacements for different units. And the general idea of everybody in that camp, it was an old mill, old worm mill, was if you're not on duty, on a guard or a picket or whatever, get out of it. Because the cadre personnel would be coming around all day and saying, what's your trade? And you'd say, I'm a dispatch rider, Sergeant. Right. Office, right away. And you find yourself posted, very often abroad. So people were advising you, if you're not on duty, get the hell out of it. Get into Huddersfield and go to the NASI or whatever. But and here I formed David Danger and I were still together then, and we formed another friendship with a man who was a corporal, and he'd been posted there. He'd been a territorial, but he'd been posted there, obviously, to find him a unit to go to. And we rather fancied this corporal was avoiding us. I was still an unpaid lance corporal, by the way. And he seemed to be dodging me, and I was dodging him, thinking that we were one of the staff, and we were looking for people to put you on various assignments. Until we met up in Huddersfield, and we laughed it off. We realized that we were both on the same side, as it were, waiting postings, and the three of us became very good friends, Crossland, Danger, and myself. And I came across him later in the war, which is very unusual, because in the Royal Signals you got moved around so much. It's not like a county regiment or an infantry unit whereby you go and you usually stay with the same company, apart from casualties, and you'd be with them perhaps throughout the war or throughout a campaign. You would be attached to different divisions, corps and what have you, all sorts of things. So generally speaking, you didn't keep friends or together for very long periods. And in fact, Danger and I got split up after about 9 months, although we've kept in touch ever since. And Crosland and I got split up for a few months and then came together again by a quirk of circumstances. And so.
And after Kirkburton?
Yes, I was sent for training as a radio and line operator at Huddersfield. They had the, I think it was the third OTB operator training battalion there. And I was trained by a lovely old man, an ex-sergeant from the First World War when it was Royal Engineers Signals, because the Royal Signals weren't formed till 1921, 22. The Royal Engineers used to do all the signal work in the First World War. And this man had done it then, and he'd been in the, I think, a Somme and Passchendaele and Ypres, and he could tell us a few stories, you know. But he's a very interesting man, and he had been in the GPO. And what he didn't know about communications, you know, it really was education. So I learnt Morse and all the procedures and all the things to do with it, and passed out as an operator, wireless and line, B3. That was the category.
What did the line training consist of?
Telephones and teleprinted communications and things like that, you know. And laying lines. But basically it was mainly Morse and radio telephone work. And of course soldiering as well. You were trained to be soldiers all the time. You were developing. We had training on machine guns and Beauforts and rifle range practice.
And this was an operator training battalion at Huddersfield?
Huddersfield. Mm. I think it lasted 60 weeks.
Any incidents that happened to you there?
No, we were kept very, very busy. And it was at a time when there were shortages, you know. North African campaign was getting, building up. And of course, they were still reinforcing from the fiasco of Dunkirk in France. Units had got back, had lost all their equipment and lost a lot of their men, been taken prisoner. And that's how I eventually got posted to 1st British Corps.
When would that have been about?
I think it was the early 1942.
Where were 1st Corps? Where did you join them?
A place called High Milton. This is why I named my house after that. It's near Doncaster. And I told you I've got some very happy memories of Yorkshire and the people.
Were you at the headquarters of First Corps?
I was for a while, yes. And then it was rather ironic. Just prior to going to First Corps, I was selected for senior NCO's course and sent to the Royal Signals place at Harrogate. If I remember rightly, it was an eight weeks course, and the idea was to give you additional training with the idea of becoming a senior NCO. And whilst I was up there, I was picked to play for the local football side. I was always a very keen football player. And in between duties, we took part in a knockout competition. And we did reasonably well. And I was selected for a team. And it wasn't just Signals, but it was Army team. And we were picked to play an RAF team in near one of the airfields in Lincolnshire, which is just a few miles away from Doncaster. And I had permission from the commanding officer on this course to play them this particular afternoon. And whilst I was away, somebody had rung up from my unit, which was Kirk Burton, and it was before I joined First Corps, to say I must come back immediately. Well, of course, I, having finished playing football, I went back for a meal. And by the time they got me back from this aerodrome or this air station out in the wilds of Lincolnshire, I forget where it was now, to Harrogate, and they told me I had to go back to my unit. Well, one man. You couldn't transport one corporal, as I was then, all the way back to Kirk Burton. So they said, here's a special railway voucher, get a train. There'd been a lot of bombing around, so trains were delayed. I eventually got to Leeds, hung around Leeds nearly all night, with the MPs stamping my pass that I was still there. And I got back to Huddersfield the early hours of the morning, I think about 6 o'clock. Then I had to get my way to Kirk Burton. By the time I got there, it must have been about 9:30 or 10. Walked into my billet and everybody gone. And it transpired that they'd come in and said, right, you, posting. And I didn't find out until a long time afterwards, because I made one or two casual friends there, you know, a few weeks we were together. Most of them had gone on a boat to Singapore, and they never heard a shot fired. They got to Singapore, I think it was February 1942, wasn't it, when Singapore fell?
February 42.
That's right. Well, they got there then, and apparently they didn't hear a shot fire. They just went straight into the prison. They'd surrendered, you see. And I understand one or two of them never came back, Shiang Prison or the Burma Railway. So you can say if I hadn't been an enthusiastic football player, I might not have, you know, one doesn't know.
So what happened to you next?
Well, I stayed with First Corps and we did a lot of training.